He's an Australian Marxist and author, and he is the you're a translator of the works of Heinrich Grossmann as well, and a curator, a
biographer, translator, editor.
Yeah, and I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you again for the Zero Books live stream. You're one of my favorites because you have a nicely economistic view of capitalism, and by that I just mean you take Marx's critique of political economy seriously. Not that you're a Bernsteinian kind of economistic Marxist.
No, I'm not a reductionist.
Right. No, you're not a reductionist, and you don't think that we can just perfect capitalism into socialism.
No, certainly not.
Right. Well, this is what I want to talk to you about today, actually, because I don't remember when it was exactly, but David Harvey, I think in 2019, was saying that capitalism had now reached a point where it was too big to fail, and that the role of the socialist today, or the Marxist today, would be to not to try to tear it down, but to prop it up so that we could make some minor adjustments here and there to make it a more humane and human form of capitalism, and slowly transform it, I think is what he said.
Yeah, it's a stunningly spurious argument, which is premised on the idea that if there's a revolution, then everything would immediately stop. And all of the infrastructure that capitalism has built up would have to be done away with, and there would have to be a new blueprint that established production again. And without that, everybody would effectively starve to death. I mean, that's the implication. But one of the important insights of the Communist Manifesto was its paean of praise to capitalism as an incredibly productive way of organizing the creation of the stuff that we need. Capitalism has been progressive in that sense, and is, in that sense, still progressive despite the problems that exist with it. So Marx's conception is not that, well, we call a halt to capitalism and then we rebuild right from the bottom up. It's rather that capitalism provides the precondition for a more productive mode of production under the control of the working class, which can seize hold of the existing productive resources, has the capacity and the intellectual ability to make them work effectively, and that a transformation can then proceed. Marx's conception of the dictatorship of the proletariat is a period after the revolution, when there is a more democratic society, but still some repression of those who want to restore the old order. And it is under the dictatorship of the proletariat that a transformation from capitalism to full communism can occur. That is, the commodity form can be progressively eliminated and production geared to the fulfillment of human needs, rather than the fetishism of the commodity continuing to exist. So the argument is a very weak one for reformism, I think. Capitalism, Marxists have been saying this for rather a long time, but capitalism is rather overripe. And that overripeness is apparent in a strictly economic sense and has been for a long time. That is, capitalism cannot consistently ensure a living to its slaves and their slavery, to paraphrase the Communist Manifesto, because it is inherently crisis prone. Its proneness to crisis is grounded in the very organisation of production itself. It's not only a problem of distribution. It's not only a problem of proportion between different industries. It's something that's grounded in what makes capitalism progressive, what has made capitalism progressive. That is, the increased productivity of human labour due to an expanded use of sophisticated machinery, equipment, scientific technique, which in Marxist jargon increases the organic composition of capital, the outlays on dead labour, machinery, equipment and so on, as opposed to living labour, that is effectively wages, that process itself of increasing the productivity of human labour undermines in the medium to long term the rate of profit. And that undermining generates economic crises. Now, there are counteracting tendencies which mean that capitalism just doesn't break down once and for all, but there is a breakdown tendency built into capitalism, something that Marx argued and that Henrik Grossman, who I've written about, elaborated upon. So capitalism is overripe in that sense, and it's overripe in a number of other senses. At the moment, it's overripe in terms of the fungal disease that is afflicting the planet. Well, actually, it's viral disease. It's afflicting the planet, which that disease is itself a consequence of the capitalist mode of production. The alienation of human beings from their natural environment is what has generated the COVID plague and has undermined the capacity of societies to deal with it, particularly the society that you sadly are living in, the United States.
The creeping anti-Americanism coming into the conversation early. Okay, what I want to say in response, I kind of want to defend Harvey a little bit here, but not ultimately. I'm on your side, but it seems to me that his conception of the problem is not one based on physical facts on the ground. Like, it's not that he thinks we're going to have to destroy all the shipping containers and we're going to have to sink all the boats in the harbors and burn down the factories and in order to create capitalism from the ground up. But rather that the distribution of capital goods right now is coordinated in such a complex way through the market and through various mechanisms, financial, computational, and so on, that to break from it would require us to have either a very effective body that would be able to do central planning very, very well, or some other mode of production with its own mechanism to coordinate distribution. And that, I guess, you know, the old libertarian objection is maybe in the background here, which is that the socialists have a calculation problem. We don't have enough knowledge to be able to figure out how to distribute what we produce effectively, and that the market, through the law of value, is doing it the best job possible, maybe not a perfect job, would be the old libertarian objection. I don't believe that's true, but I do think that overcoming the socialist calculation problem is maybe more difficult than Marxists have wanted to believe in the past. What do you think?
I think that the conception that I attributed to Harvey and what you're talking about are related. So he effectively thinks that we have to start from ground zero in terms of the way in which production is organized and coordinated after a revolution, and that it's better just to keep on with capitalism and tinker with reforms. The issue is, when can a transition to socialism begin? That's the real issue. And I think for Marxists in the classical Marxist tradition, that transformation begins when the working class takes power. It's only when the working class takes power that the priorities of the system can begin to be shifted. It's not an idea that they're shifted all at once. It's not the idea that the market will be totally abolished on the day after the revolution, which is the implication of Harvey's argument. Mm-hmm. It's rather that transition can begin and the way in which resources are allocated can begin to serve the priority of human need only after the revolution. Only then is it possible to systematically and in steps eliminate the market altogether. Not all at once, but through the decommodification of more and more of the things that we need to survive, and eventually the decommodification of everything. We have today a capacity to calculate that is absolutely incredible. And even if that capacity to calculate does not double every, what is it, double every 7 years or so over the past several decades, even if it doesn't increase at that kind of a rate with the development of technological capacity, computing capacity, chip design, and so on, even if that's not the case, there is still a phenomenal capacity to coordinate a very large number of variables across the planet. So I'm pretty confident that the issue of computation can be overcome, but it can only be overcome when the capitalist state is smashed, when there is a vastly more democratic state established in place of the capitalist state. And the capitalist class is not one which has shown itself prone to respond to rational argument about what would be best for humanity.
No, that's true.
It has shown itself committed to defending its own privileges and even its own short-term privileges, as we have learnt during the COVID crisis, where the capitalist class across the planet has called for an opening up. That happened in Australia, where there were quite effective lockdowns. The capitalist class, and for that matter, the mass media, including the liberal mass media, were vehement. No, you must open up as soon as possible, because it will be just as bad for ordinary people if they can't go to work and they can't go to a cafe. And the focus was in the media is particularly on small business owners, than if they die. So that priority is one that will only be got rid of if the core institution of the protection of the power of the capitalist class is smashed up and replaced by a thoroughly democratic kind of a state, the dictatorship of the proletariat, which, as the shit ideas in the heads of older people disappear as we die off, the need for any kind of repression will disappear, and therefore a state as we know it, a state characteristic of all class societies, can then disappear.
You know, I come out of a tiny sectarian Marxist group, which I, for the sake of not having anyone send an assassin with an ice pick after me, I will not name, because I've been tossed out of the group a few years back. But during my time there, I was relatively convinced by an argument about transitions to socialism, and about how there might not be what we conceive of as a need for a transitional program. And here's how it went. It said, if you think about Hegel's critique of the notion of gradualism, you'll notice that Hegel would talk about how the people like to have an image of change that covers up the conceptual difficulty of change. That you know, you can think of a change as something like a taking away or an adding to something, and what that covers up is that there's a moment where there's a qualitative, instantaneous, conceptual change. So, you know, you can think, well, I have a glass and I'm drinking it, and at a certain point, it's empty because I've been taking away from it. But there is actually a conceptual change, which is instantaneous, between being filled and being halfway filled. Or this is so, I don't know how convincing any of this is to you, but this is the argument that I kind of learned, and it makes a certain amount of sense to me when I think about the dictatorship of the proletariat and what the role of the proletariat would be during a revolutionary moment. The role would be to, in a moment of crisis and revolution and tumult, for the proletariat to actually take control of the mode of production and change it. There'd be a need for the dictatorship of the proletariat in order to coordinate their efforts, to help coordinate their efforts, and to provide protection from bourgeois forces. But there would be an act of transformation. And if, to the extent that the proletariat was still relying on their own exploitation in order to distribute things to themselves to create the revolution, they would, I think, be held back from real revolution. So that would be my response.
Well, where does state power fit into this? Because that's a crucial question, I think.
Well, it seems to me that state power under in a moment of revolution becomes voluntaristic rather than determined by their relationship to my cat's coming into the what's the role for state power? The state power would exist, you know. There would be it would be an organization that was coordinating, you know, violent authority, and also was helping to, as like a mechanism of communication and maybe intellectual power to make suggestions.
Yeah, it seems to me that the point of rupture is the point at which there is a transition from an old state, which is dismantled, destroyed, mm-hmm. and a new state, a new, more democratic state, like the Soviets.
Yeah, but if you have only a transformation at the level of the state, then you can have something like a coup and a move from one bourgeois power to another. If as long as the ultimate material foundation of the state would be the exploited labor of the working class. You know, if it's still based on taxation of the surplus, whether it's in the form of income or you know, or profit, then you're still dealing with a bourgeois state.
All right. I agree. But the a revolution in Marxist terms is about not just a coup or a transition or a change of the faces at the top. It's a change in the very structure of the state. Well, not a change in the sense of replacement of one structure, of one set of institutions, by a new set of institutions, which may use some of the material infrastructure of the old state, mm-hmm. the buildings and so on, mm-hmm. but which will be based on a thoroughgoing democracy, especially based in the workplaces. And that's not something that one sees in what are called revolutions, but are in fact coups, or a shift from one section of the bourgeoisie to another section of the bourgeoisie, or even a shift from the bourgeoisie to a layer of petty bourgeois who then simply occupy the positions of power in the old state and continue to maintain the old mode of production.
Right. But I'm just saying that that change to the mode of production, which then also would manifest as a change in the institutions of power in the state, and also I think the withering away of state power, you know, would
indeed,
yeah. But all of that would rely upon a period which might be a transitional period in terms of time, but which wouldn't be a transitional period in terms of its having its own conceptual basis. It wouldn't have, you wouldn't create something other than capitalism that wasn't socialism that would fill the gap in between, you know, capitalist production and socialist production. You would instead,
or communist production.
You would create a moment where the workers were seizing power to transform their own daily life and work and operate on a new basis. So the question is, how could the mechanisms that are being used now to distribute goods and to coordinate between factories continue to be used during that moment of radical transformation, I guess, more than because I don't think that what you want to do is continue to pay wages to people and have the same bonus structure and worry is what the banks are going to do. And, you know what I'm saying?
I think that the day after the revolution, I think the commanding heights of the economy would be nationalized, brought into the hands of the state and of the workers who actually work in them. And the goal would be the abolition of the commodity form and what is the most crucial aspect of the commodity form, that is wage labor, the fact that people's labor power is a commodity. Your goal would be to abolish that as well. That's not something I think that could be done overnight. But I think that the significance of the wage in workers' lives could be begun to be diminished immediately. You could, for example, you could make all public transport free the day after the revolution, or yeah, maybe a couple of days after the revolution. You could do that, and you could progressively decommodify important aspects of ordinary people's consumption.
Well, just to take that as an example, you make all public transport free, and you're doing that on the basis, I mean, first of all, there's a couple of problems that come up, which is, will this be a coordinated, I think it has to be a coordinated effort across many states. It would not just happen in the United States or just in Canada or just in China, or just in Australia. It would have to be many different nations in a coordinated effort, I think.
I think the revolution to survive it now has to be global. I do think that that's the case, but
yeah,
there may be some time disparities
between when it occurs
in different places, and steps could be taken before it's spread globally.
Yeah, I suspect that time disparity would be measured in days and weeks and not months and years and decades. Right. That's my suspicion. But in any case,
decades, I think, is definitely out.
Yeah, right. So, okay. So let's say that we have state power and the state's going to make all the transportation free for everyone. And they're going to do that by paying the bus drivers by issuing bonds or printing money to pay for the services without requiring the workers to pay a fare. The result might be that the value of the currency drops. You know, we get massive inflation because especially as investors lose confidence in their ability to invest profitably, there could be all sorts of financial repercussions of a state making these moves, and they would not even necessarily have to be the conscious, targeted decisions of a few individual bourgeois enemies. They could just be kind of a spontaneously arising set of financial or economic consequences of moves that are against the logic of the prevailing system. Like, I mean, I don't think nationalizing transportation and just paying for it for everyone is at all outside the realm of what's possible within capitalism. You know, I think we could have that, and it would, just like we can have socialized medicine, which is far more expensive.
The railways are state owned in Australia.
Yeah. So, right. So we could easily have that in the United States. We, it, And we could expand the infrastructure for public transportation within capitalism. But if we thought that this was part of a revolutionary moment and it had the implication that more and more things are going to be taken away from the realm of profitability and the market, there would be, I think, a reaction that would grow the economies of the revolting nations into economic crisis.
Well, that assumes that you would leave decision-making power in the hands of the old owners. Right. And I think that very rapidly corporations would be taken over by the state and placed into the hands of those who work in them, who would then have to sort out how to coordinate across corporations. There would have to be the emergence of some mechanisms and a continuation initially of market relations, but no longer with private ownership. This is bracketing aside petty bourgeois production and so on, which I don't think would be a priority to take into state ownership. But in terms of not just the commanding heights of the economy, that the capitalist wage employing sectors of the economy, which create the vast amount of wealth in the world today, I think that that would be taken into the hands of the workers and their state very rapidly indeed. Now, there may well be economic problems that arise in terms of how you sort out the distribution of the what would still be newly created value amongst different priorities. That would be something that would require planning institutions. It would require negotiation amongst workers in different productive enterprises and so on. And I do not have sketched out in front of me how that would work.
Right.
But if we assume that state power is in the hands of the working class through democratic institutions, if we assume that corporate power, that is the power within productive institutions, is in the hands of the working class through democratic institutions within each enterprise to replace the dictatorship of capital within the enterprise, then I think that's the framework in which this negotiation can occur and the parameters for continuing market relations and the rate at which those market relations will be eroded, which is a concomitant of the erosion of the commodity form, decommodification of the stuff we need. I think that that's the framework in which it can be sorted out.
So before we spoke, we talked about on Facebook about what we're going to talk about. And we had a back and forth, and at one point you said, you know, I'm a traditional Leninist, which means that I think that the maybe you didn't frame this as being a Leninist, but you said at one point that you thought that the aim of socialism would be the self-emancipation of the working class and that the working class were responsible for emancipating themselves. And you would agree with that. And the trouble I think some people might hear, especially you know, backwards Americans who come out of an anarchist tradition or went through a youthful infatuation with pseudo-anarchists, would be that what I hear when I hear your talk about the centralized planning through the state of distribution and the overriding of economic
constraints,
yeah, of capitalism. I was going to say the economic logic or the those economic impulses, the overriding of those by state authority. I start to hear that the revolution is about the state emancipating the workers rather than the workers emancipating themselves. I'm going to move my cat again. So now, I guess your answer is going to be that the importance here is the transformation of the state into something truly democratic. But I'll let you actually articulate that more fully than I just said.
Well, the crucial rupture, the crucial break, I think, is the seizure of state power. Mm. And that can only occur if the vast majority of the working class is in favour of it. I think that revolutionary organisation, a revolutionary party, is necessary to facilitate that process, but it can only happen through the actions of the mass of the working class. Mm. And that act, that rupture, I think, is the immediate self-emancipation of the working class. The working class taking state power, and a process in which a party of large numbers, vast numbers of workers who recognise their own material interests, who are convinced that it is necessary to get rid of the old state machine, to get rid of capitalism, can coordinate activity across societies, or across a society, or across societies, because the repressive apparatus of the capitalist state is highly centralised, can deploy resources across nations to put down uncoordinated uprisings and attempts to begin a transformation. So I think the working class needs similar kind of coordination, a similar kind of centralised institution if it's going to effectively take power. And that's what I see as the role of a revolutionary party, a vanguard party, vanguard in the sense that masses of class-conscious workers are in it. And I would point out, that's the repressive apparatus of the state out
there. Right.
Yeah, I don't think they're coming here. Masses of working people organised together to coordinate their activities. And I don't think such an organisation exists anywhere in the world on the kind of scale that would be necessary, on the kind of scale of the Bolshevik Party on the eve of the October Revolution in Russia. But I think that a successful revolution, a sustained revolution, requires that kind of an organisation. I think revolutions, workers' revolutions, may well happen without that kind of an organisation, but for them to hold on to power, it requires that kind of coordination. So it's after the revolution, after the working class is engaged in the act of self-emancipation, I think that emancipation is sustained through democratic institutions. It makes no sense to talk about a working class emancipated unless the working class has mechanisms for making decisions itself as a body of the majority of the population of the entire planet, let alone the vast majority of the population of the more developed countries in the world today.
Yeah, I can't hold myself back from making my usual utopian gesture at this moment and say, you know, I would think that the aim of, first of all, the working classes having sort of abolished themselves would transform the mode of production, that the aim of collective life would be the creation of beautiful things, or I would imagine that work itself would
life become of pleasure and interest,
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the aim would be to cooperate so that the work itself was a pleasure and a joy and of interest, and the outcome of the work would serve people's needs. I mean, it sounds, you know, like we're all going to be happy together and sing Kumbaya, but I actually think it means a little more than that. This is, I think, the aim of I do agree that having a democratic institution so that people can participate and cooperate in that endeavor, it will be vitally important. But I do also think that we should return to Harvey and try to recontextualize why he made the arguments he did. I mean, and to try to be generous to him in a way, because we are, and in this historic moment, quite far away from having any kind of power that could start to help coordinate a workers' revolution. We don't have any international party that is, we have lots of people in small sectarian groups that want to be the sectarian, you know, the new international, but we don't have it. And we don't have, because of that, we don't have any kind of plan. And so what we can see instead are moments where there are spontaneous uprisings that are expressive of the dissatisfaction and that are destructive, but that then only seem to re-entrench authoritarian power. The Arab Spring might be an example of that, even though that, you know, I think had more potential than some of the other things that came after. So I think that what David Harvey is responding to is the lack of that organization historically, you know, and I wonder why it is that we haven't been able, the left hasn't been able to, or the socialist movements or Marxists haven't been able to, or the working class themselves haven't been able to form that kind of political movement and body that's necessary. What do you think the reason is for that? And do, would you agree that Harvey's might be saying different things if that existed, that he's not just a class enemy per se, or am I being too nice to him?
Well, I mean, Harvey uses Marxist concepts, uses some Marxist concepts, and has made significant contributions to a radical and Marxist understanding of geography and other issues and so on. But for me, the bottom line of Marxism is it's about the self-emancipation of the working class and the achievement of the dictatorship of the proletariat. And he seems to reject that. But credit where it's due, yeah, his stuff is worth reading. Or
but to say he rejects that, acts as though, say he rejects that, acts as though that's in the making, you know? Like, he doesn't reject a really existing effort to create a party. He rejects that in the abstract. And the question is, like, why does he reject it in the abstract? That's one question. The other is, why is that, why has it become an issue of rejecting it only in the abstract?
Sure. Well, I think there are two levels at which this can be addressed. Mm-hmm. One is the level of capitalism's self-camouflage, the way in which capitalist relations of production generate capitalist ideology, the way in which exploitation is concealed by commodity fetishism, the relations between human beings seem to be the relations between things, the way in which workers are divided by the wage-labor-capital relationship, the way in which they compete with each other. And this means that bourgeois ideology has a ongoing foundation, and the obscuring of the nature of exploitation of capitalist society is something that is built into capitalism. Now, at the same time, there is a solvent of those ideas that's built into capitalism, and that solvent is the experience of struggle, which is generated by the fact that if we don't fight back, if we don't resist, even if it's, you know, doing that behind the boss's back at the very lowest level, if we don't resist, then we lose out, we eat less, and so on. So class struggle is built into the system, and if informed by a radical perspective, can be a solvent of bourgeois ideas. So I think that, you know, there's that continuing pressure, without yet talking about the role of the mass media, the education system, and so on, there's that continuing pressure to accept the way things are. Maybe not to embrace it, but to think, well, there's nothing that can be done about it. So that's one level. The other level is a much more historical one, and I think there the role of Stalinism is absolutely crucial. I think there was a workers' revolution in Russia. It was defeated in a way that had not been anticipated by those involved in it, or for that matter, anybody who was observing it. And it was defeated because it was isolated in a relatively backward country. And that defeat took the form of the rise of Stalinism and the substitution of workers' democracy, workers' power, by a vicious police state, which had consolidated itself by the end of the 1920s. And that Stalinism in Russia infected the entire radical wing of the workers' movement through the Communist International and the communist parties around the world. So I think that that is also extremely important in understanding the marginalization of what I would call the real Marxist tradition for a very long period of time. On the one hand, in the labor movement, you had reformists who accepted large chunks of bourgeois ideology and wanted, as Harvey seems to want, to gradually transform capitalism into socialism by getting left-wing governments elected. On the one hand, you had that. Powerful organisations in the best organised, in the countries where the working class was best organised. And on the other hand, you had communist parties, which in a whole series of countries were also powerful organisations. And then to the left of both of them were revolutionary Marxists, and in the first instance, particularly Trotskyists, but also some left communists as well, who were really marginalised from the labour movement, had no serious roots in the labour movement, except maybe sporadically in the United States. You can talk about the Teamsters' struggles in Minneapolis in the mid 1930s, where Trotskyists played an important role, and you know, even in Australia, my organisation, Socialist Alternative, can play a role in some workplaces or on some campuses. But in terms of real roots inside the working class, no, it would be self-deception to think that that has been the case anywhere, really. A few exceptions, maybe, you know, Bolivia in the 1950s, anywhere in the world since the triumph of Stalinism in Russia. So I think that those factors are crucial, but they are that you disappeared for a moment. You're back.
I'm back.
The historical factor, as opposed to the broad structure of capitalist factor which influences ideology, is one that I think is contingent. It's not something that is built into capitalism. There is scope for those who are committed to bringing about radical change, those who are committed to working class self-emancipation, to rebuild that tradition and to begin to rebuild roots in the working class. It's just that everywhere in the world, that rebuilding process is at a very, very early stage. And I think for it to progress, a sense of reality and modesty is very important. That pretending that you are the vanguard of the working class, when at very best, there are a couple of thousand of you, is a recipe for disaster. To think that you can impose a strict form of democratic centralist discipline on an organisation of a few hundred people, as opposed to open discussion, decision-making and persuading people about the decisions that have been made, I think that is also a recipe for serious problems and disorientation. Yeah.
Well, okay. You know, it strikes me that what I've got in the back of my head is, as I talk to you, is this critique from the Forrest Johnson tendency about the formation of Stalinism, where they blamed the reliance on state capitalism, which wasn't a moral failing of the Bolshevik regime, but it came out of the necessity of the Russian Revolution arising in Russia, and the need for developing the material forces to developing a proletariat itself in a way. But they pointed to the fact that state capitalism was really fully in place in the Soviet Union as the reason why Stalin could arise, as the reason why that authority could concentrate along with capital in the hands of a dictatorial police state. Would you say that that kind of critique has some merit? That the Soviet Union was state capitalist?
Yes, I would. In that respect, I agree with C.L.R. James and Raya Dunayevskaya, the Johnson Forest tendency leaders. Right. And their analysis builds on Trotsky's analysis.
Right, they came out of a Trotskyist group. That
the key factor is the isolation of the revolution, which was a consequence of the weakness of the left wing of the labor movement in the developed countries outside Russia, as well as the beginnings of the rise of Stalin inside Russia as well. You know, misdirections during the revolutionary period that lasted up until November 1923 in Germany, that the Communist International did not cover itself in glory in terms of its advice there. So, yes, I agree with that. And I would also agree that going beyond Trotsky, that the vestiges of the revolution were gone by the end of the 1920s. And what you had was a form of state capitalism, where effectively labor was still a commodity, where capital accumulation was the prime principle for economic activity and was managed by the Stalinist police state. Competition having been abolished inside Russia, but on the other hand, competition still occurring on a global scale and taking a military form.
And competition even wasn't universally or always abolished with inside Russia, because there were times where it would have to be reintroduced just to get the economy and the people fed.
There were ups and downs.
So earlier you said that maybe that the socialist left or the Marxist groups that are out there in the world right now amount to a couple thousand people. I just want to point out to you that
individual organizations at most. I don't know how many there are across the planet.
Because we can get anywhere from 10,000 to 50,000 views on one of our videos. I don't know if they're all committed communists or not, but I like to think they're
one can hope.
Well, do you feel let's talk a little bit about COVID and the current moment. Do you think that, because I think that the critique of the left as being pro-lockdown and the claim that workers want to go back to work is beginning to have more legs than it did at the beginning. It's not that it's true precisely. If you actually talk to workers, they're still very much concerned about their health and safety. But as the failure for there to be a new stimulus package in the United States and the ongoing effects of just being in a lockdown continue, human beings like to get out. They would rather be going back to social life, whether it's at work or at a restaurant. Do you feel that the Marxist left is taking a risky stance by being seen to be too pro lockdown in this moment?
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. I think that the only way in which this plague can be brought under control is by very, very vigorous lockdowns. And the more vigorous they are, the more strict they are, the shorter they can be.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I think the criticism has to be that they are being done in a half-hearted way. And we've just heard the news that in Germany and in France, they're moving back towards lockdowns, except that schools will be open and childcare will be open, which means that they will be places through which COVID can be, will be spread. Right. So I think that certainly there is an effort to persuade people that lockdowns are bad precisely for the reasons that you've given. That is, they are not vigorous enough, and they are not backed up by measures that ensure that people have enough to eat and can continue to live in some degree of comfort.
Right.
That is a mechanism that the capitalist class, consciously or unconsciously, is using to generate popular support for loosening up. But that loosening up is going to enable a recovery in profit making, but in the short term. Because
yeah, I don't understand.
The virus will spread again, and there will be.
The Chinese were smart enough to lock down for real, right? I mean, it was not, I wouldn't want to live through that the way they apparently did it, right? Mm. It was very authoritarian and inhumane at times, I've heard. But they locked down. And then now they're opening, you know, they're pretty much open, is my understanding. And now, of course, they locked down and then they did contact tracing. And really killed it off. We never had that opportunity in the United States anyway, and probably in Europe either, that there was never a moment where they had sufficient control over the spread of the virus to really do effective contact tracing and stop it. So all that was being, like, if you look at the Imperial College of London study that came out early, all that they were asking to do was to flatten the curve or to mitigate the spread. They weren't trying to really stop the virus from becoming a pandemic. So they wanted the same number of deaths just over a longer period of time.
So that the hospitals wouldn't be overburdened.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's been the strategy in the West, or at least in the Anglophone world, all along, which was itself a compromise, and a more liberal approach, than the Chinese or the South Korean even model, where you would really lock down and do severe contact tracing and quarantine. So, you know, now I'm not sure what is being argued about when I really hear people talk, but it seems like what people are wanting to say, instead of lockdown, we should just ignore the fact that we have a pandemic and we should allow people to go back to work and die in masses.
Yeah, especially old people who aren't productive.
Yeah, right. You know, as I am reaching 50, I don't feel good about that myself.
No, I'm not happy either.
Right. No, I mean, it's absurd, but somehow what's most absurd about it is that this approach guarantees that the problem will continue on and on and on. So even from the point of view of capitalism, this is a very bad decision because, you know, without any government interference, it's going to be devastating to the economy. People won't go out as much. People won't spend as much. It will hurt. If the hospitals collapse, that will hurt the economy, you know,
pressure on politicians to lock things down again repeatedly, which will be destructive. But I think that there are somewhat more bourgeois democratic models of how to deal with it. And New Zealand, I think, is a good example, and to some extent Australia as well. And in both cases, they're assisted by being island countries, and New Zealand being a relatively small in terms of population island country, Australia being a bloody big island, but still the population's not huge, and sort of on the edge of the world. So the virus had its impact somewhat later. But in New Zealand, they've effectively eliminated COVID, at least for the time being. No doubt there will be some flare-ups through, you know, visiting ships and, you know, freighters and so on. And Australia is close to that kind of a situation, but there is still immense pressure from capital to open up as rapidly as possible, which for essentially electoral reasons, some of the state governments in Australia have resisted to a certain degree, which from the point of view of public health is a good thing. There's been a lockdown which is only just this week being relaxed in Melbourne, Australia's second largest city, a lockdown that lasted months, but still had majority popular support in opinion polls. People recognised that it was important. Now, the Australian federal government, which has control of most social security measures, has rolled back the level of support for people who are affected by lockdowns and those who've lost their jobs and so on. And this is, I think, designed actually to increase pressure for loosening up. But you know, those measures of hard lockdowns for a period of time have proved to be effective, and I think could bring the situation in the United States and Europe and various other places under control over a period of time. But the more they governments foodle around, the more difficult it's going to become, and it certainly needs to be complemented by measures to ensure people's living standards are maintained.
I would love to get you on the stream with a guy named Philip Cunliffe, who wrote a book for us called Linen Lives, and he has become rather adamantly anti-lockdown.
You're interested in blood sport, are you?
Yeah, yeah, that's what I thought you said. I was just wanting to make sure. Yes, I'd love to see some blood come out of this, yeah. But yeah, you know, what we could do, you've already had your break, but what we could do is break and then come back, and you could do a second, like 30, 40 minutes with me if you wanted, just for the patrons, and you'd be doing me a favor. But I feel like we got the substantial conversation out of the way. How are you feeling right now?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, well, why don't we take 10 minutes, and then I'm going to get myself some coffee. Even though it's 6 o'clock at night, I can drink coffee. I'm a grown adult. And then we'll go for another round. Just talk about current events and what's going on. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books book club and help us to continue making online content from the left.